Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. Well, everyone, this is the big one. Episode 100 of Royally Screwed. It's also technically the final episode. We'll get more into that at the end in case this is a surprise for you. But who are we covering this episode? So, it's time for another installment of Were They Great, where we explore the reigns of rulers who were given the title The Great in order to determine if they really deserved that honor. In this installment, we're going to look at perhaps the most iconic The Great of all, King Alexander III of Macedonia, also sometimes shortened to Macedon. However, this episode of Were They Great is gonna have a twist to it. Listen, of course Alexander was great. There's a reason almost every single person knows his name. So instead of actually asking, was he great, I want to ask the question, why was he great? But here's a little bit of info about me regarding Alex. I don't really like the guy. I think he's incredibly overhyped and not that great of a human being. That being said, he's perhaps one of the most influential men in European history, if not the most influential. So this episode is going to look into why that's the case. Also, I'm gonna give you some homework just in case you haven't listened to other episodes of this show. Listen to the episodes I did over Cyrus the Great, episode 94, and the last episode I did over Leonidas and Xerxes, episode 99. That will provide you with a great background into what the world was like around the time Alexander was born. I'll go into some other stuff in the background history lesson, but there's a whole lot of other important background information I can't shove into this episode without making it way too long. So for this episode, I'm gonna do two things. First, we obviously gotta learn about the guy. Who was Alexander? Where did he come from, and why did he do what he did? Second, I'm gonna talk a bit about his legacy after his death. What happened to the lands he conquered? Who all did he influence throughout history? There's quite a bit more there than you might think. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the Mediterranean world of the 4th century BCE in Alexander III of Macedonia. Why he's great. In the background history lesson, let's bridge the gap from the Greco-Persian Wars to the rise of Alexander, and then we'll also look at the history of the Kingdom of Macedonia. Towards the end of the Greco-Persian Wars, listen to episode 99 to learn more about those, the city-state of Athens took command as the most powerful city in ancient Greece. They were at the head of what has become known as the Delian League, a group of city-states throughout modern-day Greece. In 447 BCE, after one final battle against the Achaemenid Persian Empire on Cyprus, the fighting between the two groups, the Greeks and the Persians, simmered down. Any sort of actual peace treaty between the two is debated. Later historians wrote about a Treaty of Kalias, but there's no concrete evidence for its existence. However, it seems that at least some sort of mutual agreement was reached between the Greeks and the Persians where the two would not invade the other's territories. Well, while things on a more global scale were better, things among the Greek city-states were falling apart. During the early days of the Greco-Persian Wars, Sparta had seemingly been the most powerful state, at least on land. However, the rise of Athens, which was also beginning to experiment with democracy, was beginning to threaten Sparta's self-image. After the latter refused Athens' help with an internal revolt, Greek city-states began dividing along loyalty lines. Sparta's alliance was known as the Peloponnesian League, named after the peninsula Sparta is located on, and the Athenian allies as the aforementioned Delian League. Civil war broke out around 460 BCE and continued until 445 BCE, after which a 30 years truce was agreed upon. Just 5 years later, the island of Samos, which had been part of the Delian League, wished for independence of what was quickly becoming the Athenian Empire. They had reached an alliance with some Persians who would aid them in their independence efforts. The Peloponnesian League also turned its eyes on Samos. Even though there was a truce, it didn't mean the two groups wanted the other to be successful. If Sparta intervened in Samos' affairs, war would once more break out. However, at the end of the day, both sides wished to avoid war if at all possible. So, Samos was left to be crushed by Athens. However, less than a decade later, Athens started threatening the city of Megara, which was one of Sparta's allies. This provocation forced Sparta to assert itself as a military leader, and war once more broke out in full. Fighting lasted from 431 to 404 BCE, when Sparta defeated Athens and became the leader of the Greek city-states. Both of these civil wars together are called the Peloponnesian Wars. The new Spartan Empire was incredibly short-lived, as revolts began breaking out almost immediately. By the end of the century, it was clear that things were falling apart. For a few decades, different wars broke out. It seemed like Athens might rise to power again, but the new powerhouse that eventually took control was the city of Thebes in central Greece. However, by the mid-4th century BCE, no city-state could truly say they controlled the Greek world. So, let's move slightly away from the Greek world. Kinda, maybe, sorta, but not really. Okay, so there's a massive asterisk that has to be written next to Macedonia's position as a Greek city-state. Historically, if you asked someone from ancient Sparta or Athens if the Macedonians were Greek, they would probably say no. However, the Macedonian territories bordered those of proper Greek city-states. They spoke a dialect of Greek, and they were even allowed to participate in the ancient Greek Olympics. In a sense, the Macedonians were more like that trope in a sitcom where the next-door neighbor might as well be part of the main family and it wouldn't change anything. Heck, the Macedonians fought alongside Sparta in the second phase of the Peloponnesian Wars. Later in history, some Greek historians would even argue that the Macedonians should have been included as Greeks all along because of legends that the kings of its Argead dynasty, the dynasty of Alexander, were descended from Hercules, which was also believed of the kings of Sparta. Their outsider status was also compounded by the fact that during the Greco-Persian Wars, the Macedonians had been conquered by Persia. And even after Persia was kicked out, they didn't completely lose every aspect of the culture the Persians had introduced, such as using Persian-style relics in their king's throne room. The only way that the Macedonians could get themselves on equal standing with the proper Greeks would be to show the Greeks that they were just as powerful, if not more so. Luckily, Alexander would get to do that, and he would do so by conquering the entire Greek world. And more. I believe that in order to get a full picture of Alexander, you also have to have a somewhat decent idea of who his father was. That would be King Philip II of Macedonia. When Philip was about 15 years old, his father, the King of Macedonia, was killed, and he was taken as a hostage in Thebes, which at that point in time was trying to assert its dominance over the other Greek city-states. From 368 to 365 BCE, Philip trained alongside the Theban army, which was the best Greek army at that time after it kicked Sparta's butt. When he finally returned to Macedonia in 364, he had become a tremendous soldier and had learned much about the rest of the Greek world. In 360, Philip's older brother, Perdiccas, died in battle, leaving the throne to Philip's infant nephew. Well, one quick coup later, and Philip was the new king of Macedonia. At that point in time, his kingdom had recently suffered defeats from its non-southern, very much not Greek neighbors. Philip got to work restructuring his army, making great use of his training in Thebes. His main new strategy was the phalanx, which was a very tight formation of soldiers with large shields and long spears. Imagine a porcupine with iron skin, and that's not terribly far off. Though he initially attempted diplomacy with the Thracians and Illyrians, the aforementioned non-Greek neighbors, Philip would eventually show off that he was in fact serious about turning the Macedonian army into an elite fighting force. In 354 BCE, King Philip was finally brought into the greater Greek world when he was asked to invade the region of Thessaly. His success in the region resulted in a renewed alliance with Thebes. In 353, he continued his campaigns further south and expanded his realm. The only thing stopping him at that point in time was an Athenian army waiting in central Greece, which Philip was not too keen on fighting at that point in time. In the mid-340s, he led a campaign against the Spartans, who still wanted to pretend as if they were the protectors of all things Greek. The classic story goes that Philip sent a messenger to the Spartans saying that, if he invaded Lacedaemon, the region the Spartans ruled over, he would defeat them. The Spartans, who were known for their blunt responses, simply replied, "If." Philip then proceeded to march into Lacedaemon and defeat the Spartans. In 340 and 339, Philip led two failed sieges in what is modern-day Western Turkey. These failures made the other Greek city-states rise up, thinking that maybe Philip was beginning to get past his prime. Unfortunately for them, Philip was not past his prime. In 338, he defeated a combined Theban-Athenian army and reasserted his dominance over the Greeks. After this win, he was recognized as the leader of the League of Corinth. The League was a pan-Hellenic organization of the Greek city-states that were in an alliance against the constant specter of the Achaemenid Persians. Philip had only made a couple active attempts against the Persians, but had supported various rebellions against the empire. He even went as far as to house exiled Persian nobles in his court. Even though he had failed a couple times, he viewed himself as the one guy who could take on the mighty empire. In 336, he made a final campaign to push back the Achaemenids to free Greeks in the eastern islands of the Aegean Sea and the western shores of Asia Minor. This campaign eventually fell apart because, in October of that year, Philip was assassinated by one of his bodyguards while attending his daughter's wedding. His assassination has been written about with a few different angles. One is that his bodyguard Pausanias was also his lover and was jealous of a new man in Philip's life. Famed philosopher Aristotle, who served in Philip's court as Alexander's tutor, suggested that Pausanias had been personally offended by actions of Philip's friends and family. Another angle is that Alexander and his mother, Philip's third wife Olympias, planned the murder to get Alexander on the throne. This third theory has kind of been tossed out in more modern days because, if it was ever found out that Alex had actually killed his father, that incredibly loyal army would have turned against him. However, this was an incredibly prevailing theory in the past. Nevertheless, that same day, possibly the 25th of October, at just 20 years old, Alexander was crowned the new king of the most powerful state in the Greek world. So before we actually start talking about Alexander, I want to break down how the rest of this episode is gonna go. First, we'll talk about how Alexander conquered Greece. But wait, didn't we just talk about how Philip kinda did that? Yes and no. Philip maintained an iron grip over Greece, but the southern city-states were very much free. Second, we'll look at Alexander's biggest claim to fame, his conquest of Persia. Third, we'll look at how Alexander built up his own personal legend while he was alive. And finally, we'll look into how his legend continued to inspire people throughout the course of history. So, let's kick things off immediately with Alexander cementing his rule of Macedonia. It resulted in many deaths within his extended family. First, Alexander had his cousin Amyntas killed. Amyntas had been Philip's nephew he had usurped the throne from. Next, Olympias, Alexander's mother, killed Philip's other wife, Cleopatra. Not that Cleopatra, though she'll come up later. And Alexander's half-sister, Europa. Alexander was apparently infuriated when he heard about this, which further seems to debunk the rumors that Alexander was behind Philip's assassination. However, now that Cleopatra was dead, Alexander had her uncle, who was in charge of the Macedonian army out east in Asia Minor, put to death to prevent him from seeking Alex's head in revenge. And now with things seemingly settled on the home front, it was right about time for the rest of Greece to notice what had happened. Philip's death sent a shock across the Hellenic world. After all, he had been the military leader of Greece and imposed his rule with a not-so-gentle iron grip. Riots and revolts immediately flared up across the more southern city-states. In order to prove his military might, Alexander gathered 3,000 soldiers and marched south. He first took on the Thessalians by marching over Mount Ossa, taking the Thessalians by surprise by coming up on them from behind. They surrendered on the spot, and Alexander joined them into his army as he marched further south. When his army reached Thermopylae, the famed location where the Spartans fought the Persians, Alexander was recognized as the leader of the Delphic Amphictyonic, a formerly religious but currently political organization of city-states which existed to protect temples to the goddess Demeter and the god Apollo, specifically the temple belonging to the Oracle of Delphi, which was dedicated to Apollo. With this new boost to his political prestige, Alexander marched on the city of Corinth to reassert Macedonia's position as head of the League of Corinth. From there, Alexander marched into the Peloponnesian Peninsula and put down a rebellion by the Spartans. This thrashing was so significant that the Spartans never truly recovered and forever remained on the sidelines of Greek history. And the saddest part of that is that Alexander didn't even conquer the region of Lacedaemon. He viewed the Spartans as so insignificant to his idealized Greek world that they were essentially the only major Greek region not part of his Hellenic Empire. However, by marching that far south, he had left the region of Macedonia open to invaders from the Balkans. So Alexander quickly marched back north to secure his family's ancestral lands. However, again, this march north left room for the city of Thebes to be like, hey, Alexander isn't here anymore, so let's try getting back in power. Well, after Alexander dealt with his Balkan neighbors, he quickly hightailed it down to Thebes, destroyed them in battle, and destroyed the city. The destruction of Thebes sent a shockwave across the Greek city-states, forcing them to acknowledge Alexander and Macedonia as their leader. And to make his Hellenic conquest all that more impressive, all of this happened more or less within a year of him becoming king of Macedonia. Within 1 year, he went from a prince who possibly wasn't even going to inherit the throne, there was a whole deal with Philip's other wives, to the undisputed leader of the Greek world. After securing his position as the leader of the League of Corinth, Alexander had planned for a full-scale invasion of the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Obviously, things in the Balkans and the Theban uprising put these plans on hold. However, there is a key question that has to be answered here. Why did Alexander want to conquer the Persians? After all, there hadn't been any major war between the two civilizations for over a century by this point. Well, it's probably because Philip had also wanted to conquer his eastern neighbors. That's the reason he helped establish the League of Corinth in the first place. Philip's reasons are a bit more murky, though. It might have been out of some sense of proving himself as a true member of the Greeks, and therefore he was seeking unneeded revenge for the Greco-Persian Wars. But, like I said, that revenge was unneeded. It's generally considered that the Greeks won the Greco-Persian Wars. It's also possible that he wanted to see all Greeks freed from Persian rule, seeing as several groups in Western Asia Minor who were Greeks still lived within the bounds of the Persian Empire. There's another story that's passed around that I'll get into more with the legend surrounding Alexander that might also point us in the right direction if it's true. Nonetheless, for whatever reasons, be it revenge or glory, Alexander departed for Asia Minor in April of 334 BCE. He left one of his trusted generals, a man named Antipater, as his regent in Greece. While Alexander was away, Antipater put down several rebellions in order to assert Macedonian dominance. Alexander's army at this time numbered potentially between 40 to 50,000 soldiers. The classic story of his conquest says that he began it after crossing the Hellespont, a narrow strait between northwestern Turkey and northeastern Greece, by throwing a spear into the ground and proclaiming the land as a gift to him from the gods. From there, he began his conquest in earnest by defeating a Persian army at the Battle of the Granicus, Granicus being the historical name for the Biga River, just east of the Hellespont. He then captured the important Persian city of Sardis, once the capital of the Lydian Empire, and marched south to liberate the Ionian Greek cities on the western shores of Turkey. This proved slightly more difficult, in which Alexander had to lay siege to both the cities of Miletus and Halicarnassus. However, the king of Macedonia once again proved his military might and continued conquering cities and regions along the Mediterranean coast of Asia Minor. With most of the coastal cities of Asia Minor under his control, Alexander had dealt a blow to the Persian navy as well. When the region of Caria in southwestern Turkey came under his control, Alexander left it in control of a woman named Ida, who had actually served as the Persian satrap, a position akin to a governor, up until 340 BCE. Ida decided to name Alexander as her adopted son, which further granted him a sense of legitimacy to his conquest. From there, he continued along the coast. In 333 BCE, Alexander finally came to blows with the Persian King of Kings, Darius III. So, an interesting bit of information about Darius that I found while doing research, which could potentially just be nothing. There are no Persian records of him, only Greek. Now, Persian records from this time in general are more lacking than the Greeks, as they preferred oral history. So maybe something was written about him but was just lost. Or maybe they refused to write about him because Darius, spoiler alert, would be the last Achaemenid King of Kings. Or maybe he just didn't exist and for some reason the Greek writers decided to create a Persian king whole cloth. Whatever is the truth there, the two leaders met near the present-day Syrian-Turkish border at Issus. Alexander's army beat Darius's, forcing him to retreat. This retreat came at the cost of Alexander taking Darius's family hostage. The former refused to let them go unless Darius acknowledged him as the king of Persia. Obviously, Darius refused. By the way, Darius's army at Issus was said to be about twice the size of Alexander's. Even if twice is hyperbole, he still commanded many more troops. It was just that Alexander had optimized his strategy with the Macedonian phalanx, while Darius relied on big number, do big damage, and not much else. So Alexander pushed further south and captured Syria and the Levant, modern-day Lebanon and Palestine. During his capture of the Levant in 332 BCE, he destroyed the city of Tyre, which had held historical significance in the region for ages. This destruction forced everyone further south to think twice about standing up to the Macedonian army. This shockwave thus gave Alexander a clear path to conquer his next significant region, Egypt. Before he was able to properly enter Egypt, Alexander was forced to lay siege to the city of Gaza, which, yes, is the same as the current Palestinian city and region. It is a very ancient area. Gaza was also an important Persian stronghold on the eastern Mediterranean, so Alexander gave it the same treatment as Tyre, aka destroying it. From there, he was able to easily march into Egypt. where things appeared to kinda just go smoothly. There's a very important side story that I'll get into later with Alexander's personal legend-making tendencies that might have really helped him out. So, after quite a few Egyptian cities apparently surrendered to Alexander, he was granted an incredible honor. In 332, Alexander was made the Pharaoh of Egypt, taking away the title from Darius III. Insert all of your white pharaoh memes here. He was also given the pharaonic name Setepenre Meriamun, which means elect of the god Ra and beloved of the god Amun. Alexander spent the rest of the year solidifying his rule as the new pharaoh of Egypt. He helped rebuild and restore Egyptian temples that the Persians had let fall into ruin. He even offered up sacrifices to the Egyptian gods to appease his new subjects. Granted, people in ancient cultures would often equate foreign gods with their own, so it's possible Alexander offered up sacrifices while thinking of the gods as his own Greek ones rather than distinctly different Egyptian deities. However, to solidify Egypt as part of his Hellenic Empire, he changed up taxation laws to match those found in Greece and reorganized the Egyptian military to practice his war strategies. But perhaps his most important contribution during this time was the founding of a city on the northern coast. To show his importance to the world, Alexander would name it after himself. This was not the first city Alexander had founded, it was probably his third, but the city of Alexandria, Egypt still remains one of the most important Mediterranean cities in the world, and is the only one to still bear his name. In 331 BCE, Alexander left Egypt to continue his conquest within the central regions of the Persian Empire, which aligns with modern-day Iraq. This region, Mesopotamia, held many major ancient cities, though the most important would no doubt be Babylon. Darius, fearing the oncoming storm, made Alexander an offer in three parts. First, Alexander could marry one of his daughters. Second, he would receive a massive sum of silver. And third, Alexander would be named co-ruler of Persia, ruling over everything west of the Euphrates River in Mesopotamia. Alexander refused the offer, wishing to make all of Persia his. So the two kings once more met on the field of battle near the modern-day city of Erbil, Iraq. Just as before, Darius commanded a much larger army. And just as before, Alexander defeated him. Darius fled even further east. He ended up being kidnapped by the leader of his personal guard and the satrap of Bactria in Afghanistan. He was left to die in a wagon on the side of the road, which only made Alexander's job that much easier. However, in actuality, Alexander was very disappointed that he was not the one who killed the Persian king. However, before Alexander even learned of this development, he first conquered Babylon. Alexander's sources say that Babylon easily surrendered to him, but this is probably just Alexandrian propaganda. With Babylon under his control though, and Darius dead, the king of Macedonia continued marching east. He divided his army in two to take on the two capitals of Persia, Susa and Persepolis. Alexander took Susa and looted its treasury. He then marched on Persepolis, defeated the Persian army, and allowed his army to take whatever treasures throughout the city they could find. With both cities under his control, Alexander was able to sit himself on the throne in Persepolis and name himself King of Kings, the ruler of Persia. We've got one more section to go over in Alexander's conquest of Persia, because despite being named king, there were still regions further east that had not met the pointy end of a Macedonian phalanx. For several months after naming himself king of Persia, Alexander stayed in Persepolis. During this time, the palace commissioned by Xerxes the Great, the king who led the second invasion of Greece, was burned down for vaguely unknown reasons. Some Greek and Roman historians recorded it as people in the Greek army getting revenge for the destruction of Athens during the Greco-Persian Wars. Alexander also happened to visit the tomb of Cyrus the Great, hoping to pay his respects to a great conqueror during this time, only to find out that the tomb had been looted. Like everything outside of Alexander's control, these events greatly upset him. It was also during this time that the Greeks started to notice a change in Alexander. As King of Kings of the Persians, probably hoping to appease his new Persian subjects, Alexander began taking on behaviors of ancient West Asian kings. He kept Persian nobles in positions of authority and also allowed them to worship him seemingly as more than just a mortal man, an action unthinkable in the Greek world. Over the next 3 years, Alexander pushed further into modern-day eastern Iran and Afghanistan to bring those Persian satrapies under his control. It was during this time that he learned of Darius's demise and claimed that he found Darius right before his death. He also made the claim that, with Darius's final breath, the former Persian king named Alexander his successor. Alexander then proceeded to wage war against several Persian officials who attempted to claim they were actually the successors of Darius. In 327 BCE, Alexander married his first wife, a Bactrian noblewoman named Roxana. This further upset Alexander's followers, who wished he had married a Greek woman instead. They were only slightly satisfied when he had a Macedonian-style wedding instead of a Persian one. With things seemingly settled in Western Asia, Alexander turned his attention to the furthest reaches of his new realm, the satrapies that made up modern-day Pakistan and the furthest western reaches of India. Alexander waged wars throughout 327 and 326 BCE until he had brought those regions under his control. However, Alexander was not yet done. He wanted to go further. He wanted to bring the whole world under his control. Unfortunately, the rest of his army hadn't bought tickets to that same train of thought. They had left their homes in Greece about 7 years before. For 7 years, they had continued marching further and further east with, what was now becoming apparent, no thoughts of turning home. So, Alexander's army launched a mutiny. Knowing he was far outnumbered, Alexander gave in to his army's request. Most of the Macedonian army was allowed to march straight back to the city of Susa. However, Alexander wanted one last adventure, mainly exploring the Jedrosian Desert along the border of Pakistan and Iran and the Persian Gulf. This expedition through the harsh desert cost Alexander many deaths in his army, further angering his people. He didn't arrive back in Susa until 324 BCE, 2 years after he had said he would return, where he proceeded to marry two more Persian princesses. He also had several Persian satraps executed for perceived misbehavior during his absence. Alexander made it very apparent that he would probably never return to Macedonia. He continued to adopt Persian behaviors, including Persian fashion senses, and started sending older and injured Greek soldiers back home. His army once more attempted to mutiny, to which Alexander basically said, "Okay, then I'll just use the Persian soldiers I rule over." This quickly shut up the Greeks. It seems like Alexander was then beginning to formulate plans to lead an invasion further south into the Arabian Peninsula. Alas, these plans would never come to fruition because, in June of 323 BCE, Alexander the Great died in the city of Babylon. He was only 32 years old, but he had spent the past decade conquering more land than any single man before him. His cause of death is unknown. Now, it's generally believed he probably died from malaria or some other disease, but that hasn't stopped people from insisting he was poisoned. Maybe by an upset Greek soldier, or maybe by a Persian noble dissatisfied with a Macedonian-born king. He was buried in a sarcophagus that was due to be shipped back to Macedonia for his burial. Unfortunately, along the way, one of Alexander's generals, a man named Ptolemy, stole the sarcophagus and buried it in Egypt, where it remained for centuries. And still probably does. We just don't actually know where it is anymore after the Romans blocked off access to it. Now that I've covered the extensive life and triumphs of Alexander, let's talk about how he mythologized himself within his own life. Because great PR is very important for a man set on conquering the world. Some later legends would rise up about Alexander's birth, including a story that the goddess Artemis was there because her temple at Ephesus, one of the ancient wonders of the world, potentially burned down on the same day Alexander was born. But that story wasn't spread by Alexander and those who actually knew him. One of the earliest legends about his life stems from Alexander's boyhood. When he was around 13 years old, a horse was brought to Philip, Alexander's dad, as a gift. This horse was said to be untamable and bucked off anyone who attempted to ride it. However, when Alexander decided to ride it, the horse instantly submitted to the prince. Due to either a scar or brand mark on the horse's leg that looked like an ox, Alexander named the horse Bucephalus, Greek for ox head. Bucephalus was allegedly Alexander's personal mount for most of the rest of his life, allegedly dying during Alexander's campaign out in Pakistan. After this battle, Alexander founded a city he named Bucephala along the nearby Jhelum River. Now, a well-cared-for horse could, theoretically, live to be 30 years old. Bucephalus apparently lived to be 30, but he was a war horse. So stories of his long, successful life may have been a bit exaggerated. The next legend Alexander potentially spread about himself comes during the final moments of Philip's life. Apparently, some of the last words Philip ever said to Alexander was that he was born to conquer the world, that Macedonia was far too small for someone of his ambitions. This story has sometimes been used as the reason behind Alexander's desire to conquer Persia. However, the biggest legend Alexander spread about himself was the tale about his alleged divine origins. So, during his conquest of Egypt, Alexander decided to visit the city of Siwa, which was home to a supposed great oracle. Siwa was out of the way from the other major cities, so this was a very deliberate trip. Upon visiting the oracle, Alexander was told that he was actually the son of the god Amun. Now, Amun, at this point in time, had been fused with the sun god Ra and was considered the king of the gods. Also, the oracle's temple in Siwa was dedicated to Amun. As I mentioned in the section where Alexander conquered Egypt, ancient cultures used to kinda just think of different cultures' gods as their own, just under different names. As far as Amun went, a kingly god with a sky domain, the Greeks would have thought of him as Zeus. Suddenly, Alexander, who fully took the oracle's word as gospel, was on the same level as a legendary figure like Hercules. When he arrived in the city of Memphis, he met with another oracle who agreed with the oracle in Siwa. From that point forward, Alexander began proclaiming he was the son of Zeus. Now, obviously, he was the son of Philip. Maybe. This whole Zeus story actually gets pushed further back in time with some later historians. Before Alexander's birth, apparently both Philip and Olympia had dreams. In Olympia's dream, her womb was struck by lightning, resulting in a fire that spread across the world. Philip's dream involved him placing a seal over his wife's womb. Later historians interpreted this as Philip being worried that Olympia was actually pregnant before their marriage. If this is the case, then maybe Philip wasn't actually Alexander's father. That being said, I still fully believe he was. It's said that Olympia sometimes told Alexander stories that he was actually descended from Zeus. If he was actually born out of wedlock, maybe this was her trying to cover any sense of shame he might feel if he ever learned Philip wasn't his real father. Nonetheless, Alexander went full force in sharing his divine status. In Egypt, Amun was often depicted with a ram's head, so the Macedonian started having his coins printed that depicted him with ram horns on his head. This imagery would later go on to influence Muslim scholars to connect him with a figure from the Quran identified as Dhu al-Qarnayn, he of the two horns, a figure who traveled across the world and set up barriers to protect God's people from their enemies. But of course, one of the most famous legends about Alexander is the story of the Gordian Knot. In the region of Phrygia in Asia Minor, there had once been a legend that an oracle said that whoever was next to arrive in the city of Telmessos on an ox cart would be the next king of its people. This happened to be a man named Gordias. He was named king on the spot. His son, when he became king, then commemorated this event by tying an ox cart to a post with an incredibly complex knot made of bark from a dogwood tree. Legends then continued that whoever was capable of undoing that knot would become king of Asia. Phrygia eventually fell to the Persians. When Alexander arrived in the scene in 333 BCE, he heard of the story and was told he should try undoing the knot. The classic story says that Alexander took one look at the knot and, instead of trying to untie it, cut it apart with his sword. Actual ancient Greek sources say he undid a linchpin on the cart and was able to more easily untie the knot that way. Whichever story was true, if this was even based on fact at all, Alexander and his allies viewed this as a good omen for his prospect with Persia. And I mean, yeah, he then went on to conquer the Achaemenid Empire. Alexander was incredibly important while he was alive, obviously, but he was equally important, if not more so, after his death. So what happened after he kicked it? Well, the obvious question came as to who should inherit the empire. Because Alexander had conquered an insane amount of territory, but also, at the time of his death, had no natural heirs. Not too long after his death, his wife, Roxana, gave birth to a son she named Alexander. But when he actually died, it was a more pressing matter. Alexander's closest allies met in Babylon shortly after his death to discuss the partition of the empire. Their immediate agreement was to divide the realm of Alexander into 24 satrapies, with each being given to various generals, nobles, and relatives of the late hegemon. Alexander's half-brother, Philip Aridaeus, would co-rule the empire with his future half-nephew, with a man named Perdiccas acting as Alexander IV's regent. Perdiccas was potentially the last man to speak with Alexander right before he died. He was also given Alexander's signet ring. Now, Alexander's army had a special cavalry unit called the Hetairoi. Most of this group, who were often considered among the best and closest to Alex, were not actually given a rank so they could be placed wherever Alexander felt they were best suited. Well, this lack of ranks really started becoming a problem after the king's death, because how were things supposed to be divided up between them? As to be expected, factions started forming, though Perdiccas stepped in to seemingly quell this growing sense of rebellion. Many of Alexander's closest Hetairoi were among those given satrapies, such as Ptolemy, who was given Egypt and northern Africa. In 322 BCE, Perdiccas attempted to usurp control of the entire operation by attempting to marry Alexander's full-blooded sister Cleopatra, still not that Cleopatra. Though Perdiccas was eventually killed, peace was never truly restored. Men throughout the empire, mainly members of the Hetairoi, rose up to face each other as the so-called successors of Alexander, a group we now call the Diadochi. Over the next 40 years, the Diadochi fought each other, splintering the massive empire into several pieces that changed borders frequently throughout the various battles and wars. Alexander IV and Philip Aridaeus were killed in these ensuing breakdowns. By 275 BCE, nearly 50 years after Alexander's death, things finally seemed to have settled into a semblance of peace. Egypt and parts of the Levant stayed under control of Ptolemy and his family, eventually becoming Ptolemaic Egypt, the last pharaonic dynasty, technically. Basically, everything east of Asia Minor fell under the control of a general named Seleucus, whose holdings became the Seleucid Persian Empire. A Greek officer named Lysimachus became king of Thrace, a region in northeastern Greece and western Turkey, and Asia Minor. Greece and Macedonia came under control of a man named Cassander, who was the son of Antipater, the guy Alexander made regent of Macedonia during his years of conquest. These several groups would go on to vastly change the world around them. The Ptolemies quickly fell into Egyptian customs, such as marrying their siblings and worshipping Egyptian gods. The last true pharaoh of this line would be Cleopatra, and yes, I finally mean the really famous one. The Seleucids maintained their Greekness and often tried to impose it on those who lived within their lands. One of the most famous examples of this was the Jews, whose revolt against the Seleucids resulting in the events that are remembered today with the Jewish holiday Hanukkah. The Hellenization that the Seleucids attempted, and sometimes brutally enforced, was actually part of Alexander's desires for his domain. Kinda. While Alexander had originally wanted a Hellenized Persia, after a while he eventually wanted to create a perfect hybrid of Greece and Persia. This meant that the Greek culture would come to Persia, but it also meant that Persian culture would come to Greece. This latter part never really happened. However, there are some very interesting things we can see in the furthest eastern reaches of Alexander's empire. In the 2nd century BCE, some Greeks in India converted to Buddhism. Likewise, at least this has been theorized, we start to see some Buddhist sculptures take on artistic styles introduced by the Greeks. It's also been theorized that the Buddhist concept of a bodhisattva, a person who foregoes Buddhahood to help out regular humans, was influenced by the religious cults of heroes in Greek mythology. That last part is probably just a stretch, but it goes on to show how influential Alexander's conquest was in the lands far beyond his own. However, Alexander's legacy was really felt with the rise of Rome. In the 2nd century BCE, the Greek historian Polybius was kidnapped and sent to Rome, which had rapidly expanded over the years and now controlled Greece. Polybius wrote several volumes of history books appropriately titled Histories. These books chronicled Rome's rise to power, but they began with the story of Alexander the Great. Polybius's histories became increasingly popular with the military elite in the late Roman Republic. This started a period in which basically every Roman military leader wanted to become the next Alexander the Great. This eventually culminated with the rise of Pompey the Great and Julius Caesar. Pompey admired Alexander's boyish charm and even attempted to grow his hair out to match the style Alexander was said to wear. And it said this style really didn't suit Pompey. Though we call him Pompey the Great in English, that also would have been his name in Latin, with the Great in Latin being Magnus, a title he gave himself that also was used for Alexander. Caesar was also a massive fanboy of the conqueror. There's a classic story that when Caesar was in his 30s, he cried because, by that point, Alexander had conquered Central Asia, while Caesar himself was just a cog in the Roman army. When Pompey and Caesar eventually came to blows, one of their key targets for a power grab was Ptolemaic Egypt, then ruled by Cleopatra. Caesar was even said to have visited Alexander's grave in Alexandria just so he could meet his hero. When Rome became an empire, the emperors would often visit Alexander's body. There's even a story that Emperor Augustus might have accidentally knocked off the nose from Alexander's mummy. Emperor Gaius Germanicus, aka Caligula, was said to have stolen Alexander's breastplate and built a bridge across the Hellespont just so he could emulate the great ruler. Eventually, Emperor Septimius Severus closed off access to Alexander's tomb around 200 CE. His son, Emperor Caracalla, was potentially the last person to ever visit it before knowledge of its location was lost forever. But obviously, Alexander's legacy would not follow the course of his physical body, because obviously we still know of him today. He changed the world, connecting so many different cultures to one another. I mean, it was done through the most brutal of means, though. And obviously, once he became a hit in Rome, that meant he was also just kinda part of their culture. And then Rome became the culture of Europe. Christianity eventually took hold of Rome/Europe, and then that was spread on the wave of conquest we call missionary work and forced conversions. If anything, any country that has been touched by Europe is part of the legacy of Alexander the Great. And since that means basically every human being except for those few that still remain isolated from greater society, as much as I kinda loathe to say it, the legacy of Alexander III of Macedon is technically just the rest of history. Hopefully I don't have to do much more convincing, if I even had to at all, that Alexander was great. I mean, the guy did what no Greek ruler could do in over a century since the Greco-Persian Wars began. He took down what was then one of the greatest powerhouses in the entire world with a far smaller army. He also managed to connect so many cultures together. And as I said, his history kinda just continued to outlive him up until the modern day. However, just remember that one man's great is another's terrible. To the people of Persia, Alexander was a demon riding in on a wave of bloodshed. It's possible that every peaceful capitulation that occurred during his race across Europe was actually just his people rewriting history to make Alexander seem more beloved. That being said, great doesn't have to mean good. It just means incredibly noteworthy. The amount of destruction an atomic bomb does is great. I don't think I have to tell you that those aren't good. Also, even though this is technically a Were They Great episode, I'm not here to assign a grade to Alex. While I never gave out an A+, he'd probably get one of those even if it makes me upset. I've also been meaning to revamp the grading system so that it's a bit less arbitrary, which would greatly change up the rankings. It might also mean that Herod is ranked higher than Frederick the Great, which makes me sick to think about. Maybe look forward to that in the future. I mean, even with that future changing up the grading scale, Alexander would probably rank really high. I also didn't have time for it, but Alex was probably bisexual. That's actually a really debated topic throughout history. I didn't even bring up that there was this guy named Hephaestion who was essentially Alex's second in command. Aristotle wrote of them that they were essentially one soul split among two people. That's a whole other topic though. So that's it for Alexander III's story. A historical figure so great that he became a legend in his own lifetime. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. As I said up top, this is in fact the last regularly scheduled episode of the show. I made a whole special episode about this, so go listen to that if you want more details. Hopefully this isn't the actual end of Royally Screwed. I love researching history and sharing it with y'all, and I do have more ideas for episodes. I just need a break. Thank you so much to everyone who has listened to the show, even if it was just this one episode. You mean the world to me. Keep your eyes here for what will hopefully be more episodes in the future. And when that day finally comes, I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.